Good afternoon, everybody. That's your cue to say good afternoon. Everybody still awake? Yeah, good, good. Thank you very much, Nick, for the opportunity to come visit. It kind of stuck out to me that the theme of the meeting is partnering for solutions. And then when Nick asked to talk about some of the partnerships that we all have going on, many of you in the room, many not here, but when I started tallying them all up, I thought, wow, we really got quite a bit going on. So I'm pleased to be able to just kind of briefly introduce and describe a few of them to you. One of the things I guess I kind of want to help set the stage, and you've been hearing it all afternoon, is kind of the need for, and then also the hope in, a healthy soil. With the need for, with climate change, you know, resilience to extreme weather events, greenhouse gas reductions, need to grow all this food for this burgeoning population, going from about 7.3 billion people in the world now up to over 9 billion people just in the next 35 years. The list goes on and on. Providing pollinator habitat, we rely on pollinators for about 30% of our food supply. You know, there's all these environmental reasons with water quality. The list goes on and on as the need for increasing the health of our nation's soils. And to kind of help frame this, you know, this to me was kind of impressive when I started looking at it. It was in this four-year period between 2009 and 2013, through two of our largest environmental programs and ag programs at NRCS, the CSP Conservation Stewardship Program and EQIP Environmental Quality Incentives Program, we put on soil health related practices, soil health promoting practices on around 44 million acres. I thought, well, you know, that's pretty good, until you start realizing, okay, there's approximately 400 million acres of cropland. Okay, there's about 600 million acres of range and pasture lands. So really, this is only about 4.5%. Yeah, this was just these programs. But my point is that one government entity, as blessed as we are at NRCS to have these fundings for these types of programs to help provide the financial assistance and the technical assistance to get these practices adopted, as blessed as we are, one entity is not going to do this by themselves. It's going to require much broader engagement. It's going to require all of these types of partnerships to really get it done. So I would just kind of take you through just a few of the highlights of where I see that we're really reliant on some of the research partnerships, also partnerships for increasing education and adoption, and also in the policy arena. And I have to emphasize, particularly for those of us in the service communities like NRCS and others, that we are very reliant on our research partners, because particularly in NRCS, not being a research agency. And there's a number of research projects out there that I would consider foundational to promoting soil health. The second and third columns from the right. If you could just look at soil organic carbon and CT, that's conventional tillage, versus soil organic carbon for no tillage. You can see a wide range of studies on down the line where they've increased soil organic carbon content by converting to no-till. So we know that no-till works. And then the promise of this is one of those slides that Jerry also showed, is that we increase organic carbon content in the soil, you're going to increase that available water holding capacity. So you are going to increase that resilience to drought and other extreme weather events. Of course, there's many other benefits to this too. You increase the carbon content in your soil, you're going to increase aggregation, so you can get more infiltration. Now, this figure that I'm showing here with available water holding capacity, that's not going to be the same for every soil. We know that that's different. But still, it is a hope in what we're trying to do by increasing soil health. This is another what I consider kind of foundational type of study. Is increasing carbon in the soil, we're going to reduce the bulk density of the soil, so roots can penetrate the soil better, so they can find that water easier and the nutrients easier. And then this kind of foundational literature that is available for everyone is on our website. Diane Stott's been doing it, a gentleman named Chris Smith, a number of others in NRCS have been working. And just as of 3 days ago, I looked and saw there's now 219 studies that we now have posted for the world to see on our website. You can take a little searching around to find it. Email me if you can't find it, and I'll direct you to it. But what we've also done is cross-referenced all those studies that have looked at particular parameters like aggregation, bulk density, hydraulic conductivity, soil organic carbon, those types of parameters. We've cross-referenced them with our practice standards. And so if someone looks and say, hey, you know, it looks like we need to increase aggregation here, then we have some highlighted, some particular studies where they have shown with employing these measurement, these practices in a given climate regime and a given cropping system, then this is what they were able to do. So a lot of that now that I consider kind of foundational for us all to build upon as partners, as a partnership, is available. Now, the more current research that's going on now in future, I point to this meeting right off the bat. I don't know if any of you recognize, but by my count, there's some 82 presentations, oral and poster presentations, at this meeting on soil health. That's pretty good. We're getting there. We're starting to mainstream now. Another really key partnership is what's called the Soil Renaissance, and that's led by the Noble Foundation and the Farm Foundation, and I was pleased to spend about a day and a half with them working in the development of their strategic plan, me and several others, and they came up with four different primary areas. Economics, of course, because that's going to drive adoption of these practices, research needs, education needs, and measurement needs. And they've really kind of brought a lot of the key thought leaders around the country together, and they're serving on these committees to investigate and to explore and to really kind of flesh out a lot of these needs and what we do know and don't know, and really kind of doing this under the umbrella of what they're calling the Soil Renaissance. So that is a real key partnership for all of us too. And then, of course, I need to point out the partnerships that exist currently, always have, but that really exist now with ARS and with NIFA. We're working with them to help identify some of the priority research needs. ARS is working those needs into their national program structure. Every 5 years, they update their national programs. They have their laboratories around the country conducting research on all these topics. And there's a number of those, a couple at least of their national programs that are conducting research in this. And then NIFA also takes some of those ideas that we provide and incorporates that into their announcements for program funding for their grants to land grants and others. And then I also want to pull out, you heard it earlier today, their Conservation Innovation Grants Program. Over the last 3 years inclusive, we've provided $11 million to 25 different soil health related projects. The word research is a little bit loose here because generally these are demonstration projects. Generally they are for expanding adoption of something that's already been researched. But as of the last farm bill, we now have that authority and opportunity to also conduct on-farm research. And if those of you are interested in pursuing conservation innovation grants, there was another change in the farm bill that some people have not quite clued into yet. And that is, it used to be that about half of your match had to be cash. There's 50% match, and half of that had to be cash. As of the last farm bill, it can all be any combination of in-kind or cash. And so that does, I think, open up the door to a number of other universities and foundations and others that may not have the cash ready on hand, but they do have that in-kind contribution. So under the headings of adoption and education for enhancing soil health, you've just heard it from Larry. Larry did a very good job describing the soil health partnership that Nick here leads. I've got to tell you, he's a very effective leader. He's soft-spoken, as you can tell, but he's a taskmaster. He doesn't let you get by with much. He emails you. He keeps you going. He's doing a real fantastic job. Let me know when you're ready to come to NRCS, Nick. Sorry. No, I'm not. Not really. No. I stole Bianca unabashedly from Cornell. Yeah, let's go. But this, yeah, being led by National Corn Growers, but involves Walton Foundation. They're supporting the Monsanto, the Nature Conservancy, Environmental Defense Fund. Of course, NRCS, ARS, a number of different universities. Several of us are serving like on the Science Advisory Board for this. And what is cool about that you heard from Larry, is that they have a goal of a minimum of 20 new soil health demonstration sites and farms per year for 5 years. And they're just finished their second year, and they're on target. And it's just really exciting because that's what's going to drive the farmer adoption. And they're having a field days. Here's Tim Smith out in Iowa. He raises, I think, a lot of corn and soybeans on about 800 acres. He's very effective. He was one of the guys that just recently received an award at the White House as a result of his work. It's what they call the Champions of Change. Then another really cool partnership that we had that's actually ongoing, but it was really kind of came to the forefront last year, was working with SARE and the Howard G. Buffett Foundation, Soil and Water Conservation Society, and a number of others to hold this national conference on cover crops and soil health. And Howard provided funding for over 300 people for about 3 days to come to a hotel, the fly-in, to Omaha, and basically footed the bill so that we could bring in everybody so that, you know, funding, the travel funding, didn't prevent them from getting there. And one of the cool things that, you know, this is, I guess, kind of how partnerships gel. Rob Myers with USDA SARE, he's the North Central Regional Coordinator out of University of Missouri, and I were meeting with Howard, sitting down in his office on his farm. And we started talking about doing this, and then I recognized, well, you know, we just invested in all these video teleconference units at all of our NRCS offices. What if we invite farmers in? We realized we weren't going to have the bandwidth once we brought in the techies on it, but then we still did it, because we just did it as a webcast. And so what we did is we had our NRCS folks and many of our extension cooperators invite farmers and ranchers into their offices to view the webcast of that morning's presentations with Howard Buffett and the chief of NRCS and others. And then when the webcast went away, then they had a facilitated discussion on what it is that you heard that you feel like you can adopt on your farm. Well, what do you see as barriers to prevent you from adopting these things? Well, how did you, Joe Smith, adopt that? How did you overcome those barriers? And so we sent out facilitation survival kits to each of these, clearly with PowerPoints and with talking points and stuff like that. And it was actually really very effective. We had 223 sites participate, and in that one day we reached 6,000 farmers and ranchers. So that's kind of my point, is that's kind of the power of partnerships, right? It all started with that conversation. Hey, what if? And then you just, you know, you put two and two together, and sometimes it works. And this is a situation where it worked really well. Another really strong partner is NACD. Probably most of you know NACD, National Association of Conservation Districts. They have over 3,000 districts nationwide. Many of them are embedded in the same offices and stuff, locations with NRCS and other groups. These are like local units of government, but they're kind of state-supported. And they, last year, had a national soil health forum. But another thing that they're doing right now is we have an agreement with them that they are developing an inventory and database of all the soil health demonstration sites and field days available around the country. So once we get that posted, then that's going to by far expand people's, you know, their knowledge and availability of these field days, these demonstration sites to go to. Of course, NRCS, with our National Soil Health Campaign, we rely on many different partners for that campaign to be effective. First and foremost is with our farmers and ranchers, with telling their stories. They, you know, their testimonials of how they overcame barriers, how they adopted these practices, how long it took them to adopt it, how, you know, effective economically it was for them. That's like really some of the strongest testimony you can provide to increase adoption. And then we also provide communications, education material that's available on the website, but some of them are large posters, but we mail them out from a distribution center in Fort Worth, mail them for free. For people that want them and that can use them for their field days. And they're not only available in English, but also in Spanish. And then I also kind of want to take the opportunity here to thank a number of folks that are here in the room, but many that are not here also, because our science and technology training library is also available to everyone. You can find it on conservationwebinars.net, And the last time I looked, we had 40 soil health training webinars on there. And these are not just like a seminar on one person's individual study. These are training sessions where you bring in, you know, where you bring in like some of the leading experts from universities, from ARS, foundations, and elsewhere that provide training sessions. And there's hundreds of these now available. As I say, 40 of them in soil health. In last year, fiscal year 2015, we had over 30,000 logins to these webinars, and over 13,500 of them were from partners. So we're not just training ourselves, but our partners are reaching out, and it's really getting an international audience too. So all of those are available for enhancing the partnership. So this is being done. It's something other partners don't have to do, or if they do, they can work with us on it. And so this is something that's available. I want to make sure you are aware of. You can just do a search to say on conservationwebinars.net. Another thing we're doing in NRCS is we've stood up a soil health division. For the last two and a half years, I've been saying we're in the process of standing up. You wouldn't believe all the battle scars I have for that, but I'm still standing, and we do now have stood up our soil health division. We do have on your far left there a partnership liaison position that's still vacant, but many of the other positions, all but one or two of the other positions, have now been filled. The bottom two boxes I'll point out to you, the regional team leaders for four different regions, and then under each of them is three regional soil health specialists. So that's a cadre of 16 people that are distributed around the country, and each of them has a service area. So the little circles there are the soil health regional specialists, the regional team leaders, and then we've got a couple of others in there too with national leaders and national soil health specialists. Diane Stott is here in the audience. She's our national soil health specialist, the director over in D.C. One of the things you'll point out, you'll see, is that only one of these individuals is in D.C. with me. The rest are distributed around the country because that's where we want them. And their charge, my charge to them, is to become regional experts, those experts in that area that they are to service on the climate, on the cropping systems, on the soils, on what it is that makes the different farmers tick, their decision points, what are the constraints they have, what are their cover crop planting, windows of opportunity in different cropping systems, all these things. But they're not going to be doing this by themselves. The reason that I have pointed out here, also all the other dots, is the land grant universities. It's critical that they reach out to the land grants, that they make the most use of those partnerships that are available to them, also with the ARS locations, with the foundations, and many others. So this is something we're just really excited about. About half of those people are reported to duty. About another 30-40% of them will be on duty within the next 1 or 2 months. And so this is something that we're going to be really moving out on this coming year. I just highlight a few of the things policy related, because sure, it takes policy also. This is a Bill Buckner from the Noble Foundation. You'll see he's standing in front of a sign called the Farm Foundation, and this is an event that they organized and held to really kind of help educate the general public, and it was held at a pretty high level at the National Press Club in D.C., and it was webcast also. And so you'll see, you know, you got the Farm Foundation, the Noble Foundation, NRCS, you have a conventional producer, an organic producer, then John Larson with National Association of Conservation Districts. So again, all those different partners that have come there together to, you know, present a combined voice for the importance of soil health the nation. And this is something really cool that the Conservation Technology Information Center organized. Laura Moody's in the audience. She was a panelist, a participant in it. I don't know if many of you realize this, but a lot of our legislation in D.C. is written by people a lot younger than me. They're in their early 20s. And they come there for the experience. They sure as heck don't come there for the salary. The pay is extremely low. there are many of them sometimes to a room in their apartments and stuff, but they come in because of the richness of the experience. And so, guess what? The way to bring them in to hear what's the difference between dirt and soil is to bring lunch. And so that's what they did. And they had bags and bags and bags of chicken sandwiches and drinks, and they kept falling in. And I was standing in the back of the room, and I counted over 80 of them. And these are the people, yeah, they're in their 20s, but they're writing farm bill legislation. And they're writing all these other things that impact our ability to enhance the health of our nation's soils. So this was actually a very, very effective. Hans is here. Hans was the presenter. You can see he's the tall guy. He's kind of blending in with the back door there. Look at right in the corner of the room, the tall guy in the back. That's Hans. He's been in the back here. I think you're wearing the same sport coat, but I was wearing the same red tie. I noticed at the National Press Club this morning, when I looked through the slides this morning, I was wearing the same tie. So you're forgiven for wearing the same sport coat, Hans. But this, again, it was another effective way of just kind of educating folks on the value of soil health. We've heard it talked about two or three talks ago with a little bit of disdain on our efforts to kind of harmonize our cover crop policies. We learned that, you know, while we are promoting cover crops in NRCS, there are some farmers that are going awry, becoming ineligible with some of their crop insurance carriers for growing cover crops too long. And so I pulled together folks from RMA, Risk Management Agency of USDA, USDA's Farm Service Agency. We had a lot of 7 a.m. meetings, one after another. How do we do this? We ended up using a modeling approach where we used a 50-year weather generator for modeling crop production, crop growth, water uptake with and without cover crops, how much in different soils, different tillage practices, these types of things. And they're not perfect, but when you try to do something like this across the entire U.S., it ain't easy. But I think we've moved a long way. Since we first released these a couple years ago, we've already had about 3 revisions. We still have some issues in the summer fallow region. It's kind of the further you get into that semi-arid climate where it becomes more and more critical of when you terminate that cover crop so that it doesn't take up that moisture that could negatively impact the yield of your main crop. Then, it's like when you get in that fringe area there, it becomes more of an issue. And so it's harder. Right? And so we still have some issues there, but I think we've come a long way. We still have a lot of education to do with some of the insurance carriers to recognize that this flexibility is out there. But I will tell you that the administrators of the Risk Management Agency wants that flexibility. He wants that local flexibility so that farmers can use cover crops without becoming ineligible for their crop insurance carrier. Another thing I'll just share with you, I'm almost through here, Nick, is that particular national conference we had on cover crops and soil health, one of the things that we had, is these listening sessions and kind of working groups to identify what some of the issues were. And from that, Rob Myers, University of Missouri, and the North Central Regional Director for SARE, and I co-led a group that's involved National Wildlife Federation, American Soybean Association, SWCS, Soil and Water Conservation Society, ARS, different universities, DuPont Pioneer, and others, just kind of a range of partners that has encapsulated a number of these key recommendations that came from that conference. And this group has then come to D.C. and has met with the administrators of many different USDA agencies to help communicate what that need is. Since I'm USDA, I mostly kind of sit in the room and try to be quiet because I'm a little bit on thin ice making recommendations to another USDA agency. Sometimes I have a hard time being quiet anyway. But another thing that kind of is kind of cool that came out of this was there was a letter expressing a common vision for adopting and enhancing cover crops and soil health that was signed by over 40 organizations that was shared with these people. And so they see all all of agriculture, wildlife, many of these other interest groups, they all recognize that by focusing on soil health, that there are not only these production benefits for the farmer and rancher, but there are also these environmental benefits. And so that's what, in my mind, is one of the beauties of soil health, is it allows us to simultaneously address so many of these more pressing natural resource issues that we have, while being able to grow, giving us a fighting chance, at least, at dealing with drought resilience and other extreme weather events, so that we can grow all this food for this burgeoning population on a shrinking available land base. So I would just end there and just, you know, I made already reference to my age, and one of the things that, you know, I'm learning as I age, the more you get older, the more you start to realize all the benefits that you attained from those that came in front of you. And then really kind of what you want to do also for those that are going to become after you. And I really do think that by focusing on soil health is a way that we can really kind of help prepare the earth and prepare those next generations for a fruitful life. So I will end there and turn it back over to you, Nick. Thanks. Oh, there's one in the back.
You mentioned that you have several publications of studies that dealt with cover crops on the NRCS website. Is that correct?
Yeah.
How is that publicized? How does the general public know about that? I've been in NRCS offices all over our state.
Yeah.
And I kind of knew you had that, but I approach things a little bit differently than the general farmer did.
It's publicized in a different number of ways. You know, we try to have real close communication with all of our states, our state offices. Our chief meets with them about every 1 to 2 weeks at a minimum, and we've like announced it to them, to all the state conservationists, so then they are aware of it for their staff. We've also had webinars on it, introducing it to people so they can go on to conservation webinars, they can see it, they can see all the different attributes that are in it. But that particular, I mean, we sometimes, you know, we'll get something out, like if there's a big pollinator event or something like that, it'll be kind of a mass, you know, national press release. This was something that didn't really rise to that, level. And my, you know, I guess I kind of hate to put it that way, but it was one of those things that we did not put out like as a national press, because this is literature that already exists. But we're trying to, you know, kind of get the word out by talking today and other places to let people know it's there. Yeah. What are you going to help him out with? Getting it announced that it's out there.
And I'll get some stuff to put on.
Yeah.
Perfect. Great. Excellent. Any other burning questions? Yes.
Dr. Honeycutt, I was hoping you could talk about CSB and enhancements and how NRCS is integrating soil health.
Yeah, you know, we are CSP, the Conservation Stewardship Program, is a program that is really kind of meant as an enhancement. The word enhancement is really key there. It's something that when folks kind of introduced certain management systems and practices that might be kind of considered entry level, but then the CSP is something that's really kind of meant for help providing that financial assistance to help them expand it, really enhance upon it, and to lengthen it. Our CSP program is currently under some revision, some improvements. And there are a number of things with our soil health promoting practices that we are using CSP for, like for cover crops. I probably need to pull in some other people's to answer your question more completely, Sean, but there are things that we're doing, like for cover crops, for like extending the period of payment, for example, so that people will kind of help them get over that transition period. For example, with, you know, generally when we have a contract, it's often for about a 3-year period. Now we're having a 5-year period. We're also providing financial assistance for some of these soil health measures. So that, you know, it's kind of all part of an adaptive nutrient management process, but still under soil health. So there's a kind of a number of things like that. And, you know, our, not trying to get too much in the weeds, but we have what's called regional payment, you know, scenarios. The agency years and years ago was dealing off of receipts. When people turn in receipts, that got way, way too unwieldy. And so now there's kind of regional payment scenarios for different practices. How much does it cost to implement this practice in one region or another? And a number of those regional payment scenarios are now calling out the specific soil health types of promoting practices. So those are some of the ways that we're doing it. But if you'd like to follow up for more detail, I can tune you into the right people.
Just a follow-up question.
Wait, is it okay if he gets two questions? It depends on how hard it is. Yeah, go ahead, Sean. I may or may not answer. Go ahead.
Well, I wonder what your thoughts are on developing a robust soil health metric. You can go beyond, you know, the SDI that NRCS currently uses. You know, perhaps taking a page from Cornell University, looking at the, you know, chemical, physical, and biological indicators, and how that might be integrated in the CSP in terms of payment for services or your improving soil.
Yeah, I'm very excited about that opportunity. We've had some discussions. The last time was, what, about an hour and a half ago, Doug, on just that. I don't know if you were here earlier for another presentation, a couple other. I guess it was Chuck Rice talking about the phospholipid fatty acid analysis and the, kind of the promise that was showing for segregating different practice impacts and different tillage impacts and different even differences in crop residue that, you know, can influence biological activity and nutrient availability and these things. So I think that, in fact, I just talked with Diane and Doug about, you know, pulling people together and seeing what is there, what we could do to pull together some type of kind of a semi-universal measurement types approaches. And I think that that has a huge potential for CSP and other programs, just resource stewardship in general. I think it potentially could be applied to the field to market discussions that were going on and other things that we're doing in our agency called a resource stewardship a concept that we're working on. So I think it has a whole lot of potential. Would love to see it. Yep. Thanks, Nick. Thanks, everybody.